From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process with today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival, in year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On this week's special holiday episode of On Story, we bring you The Polar Express and Big Fish, two classic films adapted from popular books which were seemingly unadaptable to film.
We were all sitting around in Fiji talking about Christmas when we were filming Castaway, and each of us realized that we'd been reading The Polar Express to our kids. And it was this wonderful, magical book that we all loved.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're looking at two classic films adapted from popular books which were seemingly unadaptable on film in this episode of On Story. We begin with a conversation about the adaptation of a beloved holiday story, The Polar Express. Based on the classic 1985 children's book written by Chris Van Allsburg, the screen adaptation of The Polar Express was co-written by Bill Broyles and Robert Zemeckis, who also produced and directed the film. The Polar Express features Tom Hanks in six distinct roles, including that of the conductor. At the time of its release in 2004, The Polar Express was the first animated film to use performance capture technology. It was also the first feature-length film to be released in both 35mm and IMAX 3D. Sadly, the film was the last acting role for actor Michael Jeter, who passed away in 2003. The Polar Express was nominated for three Academy Awards, including Best Original Song, Believe, by Josh Groban. Bill Broyles created the Emmy Award-winning television series China Beach and has written the screenplays for Castaway, Jarhead, Unfaithful, Apollo 13, and Flags of Our Fathers. He's also co-creator and producer of the television series Six. I spoke with Bill Broyles during a special holiday screening of The Polar Express in 2013 at the Bullock Texas State History Museum. Clips copyright Warner Brothers Entertainment, Inc.
Well, you coming?
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course! This is the Polar Express!
The North Pole?
I see. Hold this, please. Thank you. Is this you?
Yeah.
Well, it says here, no photo with the department store Santa this year. No letter to Santa. And you made your sister put out the milk and cookies. Mm-mm. Sounds to me like this is your crucial year. If I were you, I would think about climbing on board.
So had you read the book to your kids prior?
Yeah, in fact, Bob Zemeckis, the director, and Tom Hanks, who plays so many parts in this, we had done a movie called Castaway together, and I had done Apollo 13 with Tom. And we were all sitting around in Fiji talking about Christmas when we were filming Castaway. And each of us realized that we'd been reading The Polar Express to our kids. And then it was this wonderful, magical book that we all loved. And so we decided, why don't we make a movie out of it, which was an interesting challenge, because those of you who know the book, it's just mainly illustrations, and you could write all the words on it in a couple of pages. The idea was, well, let's make a movie that looks like the book. And that's what the process of creativity was. And Chris Van Allsburg was really helpful. The reason all of us, you know, wanted to make the movie is because we really wanted to do something that captured that magic of childhood and Christmas, which is childhood and Christmas intersecting is about as good as it gets. And we also wanted a character who didn't have Christmas work for him, which is the Billy character. And just we thought it had that some mythic, deep mythic elements of a classic journey, you know, where you leave home and you go on this adventure and you return as somebody different than when you left, which is the fundamental story of all time, really. But to have it be a young boy on Christmas and not be an Argonaut or traveling on, you know, it was on a train to Santa Claus. This is the first movie that used entirely the motion capture, which is you see all the time in other movies now, most spectacularly in Avatar. I don't know if any of you have seen this in 3D, but it's extraordinary. But we didn't have any idea that we were actually in doing this in the technology you use for motion capture. We were essentially making a 3D movie. And it was all because it's all on the computer. So it starts with an idea to make it look like the Polar Express. And then really the real question was, well, what actually happens and how do you make a movie out of it? And what does the North Pole look like anyway? I mean, and the beautiful thing about this motion capture technology and about films now is that if you can imagine it, you can put it on the screen. And just that wonderful shot of the ticket that goes on and on and on and then finally comes back was a lot of that. Those things were just fun to imagine. But also, who are the people on the train and what do they represent and what do they really need from Christmas that's not a physical present, right? Because, I mean, kids, you know, a lot of the fun of Christmas is opening your presents, but really, as you get older, it's what you learn from each other and from Christmas that's really important. So we had to create characters, each of whom was either very disappointed about Christmas or had a big exaggerated expectation or had different things they had to learn. And the girl character was my favorite because she was such a natural leader but so unsure of herself. And whenever you ask her, are you sure, you know, she would freeze. Her learning that she really was a leader was, you know, a wonderful part of that journey. So each of the kids goes on, they all go on the journey together, but they each go on it separately.
Where are you going with that? It's for him. I don't think we're supposed to leave our seats.
Yeah, it's a violation of railroad safety regulations for a kid to cross moving cars without a grown-up.
I think I'll be okay. Are you sure?
What about this lad in the back? Did he get any refreshment?
Mm-mm.
Well, let's take some to him, by all means. Watch your step now, watch your step.
One of the things we learned with Castaway and, of course, Apollo 13 is that you don't have a movie if everything goes right. So one of the things we used to extend the middle part of the journey was just to imagine what might not go right. It's just sort of like asking the question, what would happen? Well, would you have to have a ticket? Well, where would the ticket come from? What would it be like? And wait, will somebody have to punch the ticket? Well, there has to be a conductor, right? So it's just these series of things to try to imagine what a journey to the North Pole would be really like. Well, wouldn't you be cold? Wouldn't you be thirsty? Wouldn't you want some hot chocolate? Just a simple idea like that, you think, well, how would you make it interesting? And what happens if the ticket gets lost? A lot of people think that what screenwriters write is what people say, that they just do the dialogue. Well, really, that's the last and least important thing of writing the movie. The key is, how do you tell a story visually? And what was so exciting about the Polar Express is we could do all these things without much dialogue. You know, you could do the whole thing with the ticket. You could do the caribou and the twins, the engineer and the coal man, and all the stuff with them, and then losing the Cotter Key and going down Glacier Gulch, and then coming up with Hobo on top of the train. He's my favorite character, and it's actually the one Tom Hanks, he plays the hobo, he plays the boy, he plays the conductor, he plays Santa Claus. We were kidding him all the time about, is there anything you're not going to do? Are you really going to take the tickets in the theater? And I also thought we should, you know, the fun part was we were getting all the way through. We thought, well, wait, shouldn't he think this is a dream and try to wake himself up? And that's one of my favorite parts is when he sticks his face in the snow. And I'm a big skier, so I wanted to get the skis in. And he does a beautiful little kick turn on top of the train. since we were using this new technology, we could do anything. We could do the Glacier Gulch. We could do the ticket. We could do all those things that in Santa Claus circling with the sleigh. Here was the other reason I loved doing the movie was that two of my kids are on the train. And they came out to the set, and you dress in this really kind of tights all over, and they put little kind of stars on you. They're like receptors, and they're receptors for the infrared cameras, which are in a circle. And so they move all around, sit on the train, and then they do your face with all this kind of computer technology. So every one of the faces is generated based on a real child, but then they're manipulated in the computer, and all the movements and everything are filmed. And you know, when Tom Hanks is playing the boy, we had to put a head on the conductor. On a stick, so he would be looking up at the right thing as opposed to looking straight ahead, because he's an adult, of course. And that was in the dance, by the way, the hot chocolate dance. They did that.
Wow.
Everything in there, the talent is incredible. They actually did that dance, the backflips, everything, except the throwing the hot chocolate. I've had so much fun doing that. When I'm starting a project, I'll work and work and work and try to figure out something. And I look at the clock and like 15 minutes have gone by. And I think, oh my gosh, I'll never get there. So the beginnings and the creative stages, you know, those are the hardest ones, because it's like you're looking at 1,000 doors and you don't know which ones to go through. But as you get farther on, and particularly in the revision process, you know, I'll end up working much longer hours because I build up some momentum and I know what I'm doing, and there are fewer and fewer doors and possibilities. But inspiration is a small part of what I do. Most of it's just work. If I waited to be inspired, I wouldn't get anything done. The other thing is that the writing is a process of exploration. I mean, I was just talking about, well, do you have a ticket? You know, then you have to have a conductor. Then what happens if the ticket is lost? I don't think those things up like in a flash of inspiration. It's like one thing gives you like you build a little tower, and then you can see the next thing, and then you can see the next thing. And so I really write to find out what I'm doing, as opposed to putting down what I know. One of the things that's great about collaboration is that as a writer, the hardest thing is to get some objectivity on your work, because most writers think, oh, this is brilliant, I'm so great, I love it. But if you have a partner, there's an instant kind of objective, critical voice in your, not just in your head, but right next to you. So that's really good, but you have to really trust the person you're writing with. It just was something we were so passionate about doing, because it took us back to our very own childhoods, and we all cried, you know, at the end. But the main thing is, I just wanted to say one last thing. Merry Christmas, everybody.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're looking at two classic films adapted from popular books, which were seemingly unadaptable to film, on this episode of On Story. Based on the 1998 novel of the same name, Big Fish was adapted from book to screenplay and ultimately to the stage by screenwriter John August. The film, directed by Tim Burton, tells the story of Edward Bloom, a former traveling salesman with a gift for storytelling. Young Edward Bloom is played by Ewan McGregor. Academy Award-nominated actor Albert Finney plays the senior Edward Bloom. Big Fish marks the first American feature film for actress Marion Cotillard and features an extensive cast including Jessica Lange, Helena Bonham Carter, Billy Crudup, and many more. Big Fish was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score. John August's screenwriting credits include Go, Big Fish, Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and both Charlie's Angels films. He also wrote the book for the Broadway musical version of Big Fish. Daniel Wallace is an American author, best known for his 1998 novel, Big Fish, a novel of mythic proportions, which was the basis for the Tim Burton film, Big Fish, and the Broadway musical as well. His other books include Ray in Reverse and The Watermelon King. Writer and professor Fred Stripe sat down with author Daniel Wallace and screenwriter John August during the 20th anniversary of Austin Film Festival. Clips copyright Columbia Pictures Industries, Inc.
In telling the story of my father's life, it's impossible to separate fact from the fiction, the man from the myth. The best I can do is to tell it the way he told me.
If there was one thing you can say about it, Boom Boom,
was that I was intended for larger things. I was the biggest thing Ashton had ever seen.
I'd like to start with your journey, Daniel, where this idea came from and how the journey began for you.
It started with the title, Big Fish. I had that on a scrap of paper taped to my wall above my computer, and I thought that is the perfect title for a book. I just have to write the book. I had no idea what it would be. Honestly, it came from something my father always said, a phrase that I'm sure you're familiar with. He was a businessman. He became pretty successful. And he always said he didn't want to be a big fish in a little pond. So that's why he left the little town where he was born and moved to the big city of Birmingham, Alabama. He said that a lot, and it was just very evocative in so many different ways. I'd written 4 or 5 novels prior to this book. None of them they weren't good. And I had a son, and when he was born, I didn't have as much time to write. And it gave me kind of a structure to write in, and he determined in large part the structure of the book, and through him having been born and me connecting on a subject that I was passionate about, which is mythology and this father-son dynamic, it kind of coalesced in a way that you can't explain sometimes. I mean, it was 14 years that I'd been writing and very, very limited success. So I felt this is going to be my last go at it. I'm going to write something that I really love. Regardless of what happened, I'd be proud of it. It was eventually accepted for publication. But at the same time, I don't know if you know this, John, I didn't know I had a film agent. And they were submitting the book. And so when I found out that John wanted to write it, I was double shocked, I mean, that anybody would want to turn this into a movie, first of all, because if you look at it, there's absolutely no plot and there's one character, basically. And so it doesn't read. And I think the publisher actually said when they bought it, they said, we love the book, but of all the books we've ever published, this has the least chance of becoming a movie. And, you know, it took off from there, but it was life-changing, game-changing for me since I was struggling as a writer and living a good life, but had absolutely no money at the end of the month. And I had money at the end of the month after this movie started. So, in the same time, it's the best advertising possible for a novel, a movie. And my goal is to get readers, and I think it sold 30,000 copies, which is a lot for a book like this before the movie came out.
30,001 copies now. So
30,001.
Yeah.
But after the movie, it was, really quickly, it was 250,000. And it's continued to sell copies. And so much of that is due to the movie. It's a small book, and it would have just remained a small book.
Daniel at one point was being interviewed and said, I finally figured out that what I was writing was the kind of books I thought other people wanted to read, not the kind I wanted to write. That's when Big Fish happened. and why it was a breakthrough for me. And I think that underlines you finally just started writing from, I guess, your heart and your intuition and not trying to write for whatever it is out there that you think you should be writing for.
Yeah, to a marketplace, this idea that there's a market for the kind of book, this particular kind of book that I was trying to write, which is very plot dependent and realistic, and just, it wasn't me. My father would, I gave him some of my books. He never read Big Fish, but I would let him read a couple of them. And he would say, why can't you write a really fun story? And, you know, something that people carry on airplanes, and, you know, you could make a lot of money doing that. And I said, if I could do that, I would do that. I would write a book to make $1 million. I would love to do that. This is what I do. This is how I write. And eventually, I followed whatever, you know, what I was passionate about. I think John would agree that if you're not passionate about it, it's not going to work. Yeah.
And now I'm interested in your approach to screenwriting, because you've bridged into doing that. And so is your approach the same? And how do you divvy up your novel writing versus your screenwriting? Do you do it in tandem or separately?
Yeah. The first script I read was Big Fish. I'd never read a script before, and I just loved the way screenplays were written. And I was so lucky to have read the first script that I ever read. It was written by John August, who, you know, is brilliant and can do anything. But it's two different sides of the brain, and I can't write two novels at the same time, but I can work on a book novel and work on a script. At the same time, I don't plot that out either, which is because I never did it with my novels. I don't do it with the scripts either. The analogy, and it might have been did Dr. O teach up there with you somewhere up there? He said it's like, you know, driving at night. You just can see far enough ahead of you to know where you're going. And then as you break through, you know, you can just go farther and farther. And that's how I like to do it.
So I'm just wondering how that happened, because your publisher gets you a deal. It's all great. And then suddenly you hear that you're being shopped as
I think because it leaves me here and kind of goes over to John, because that apparently literary agents in New York have sub agents in Los Angeles who they work sort of casually with. It's not contractual. So they took it and showed it to John. And I just learned, actually, they gave him 24 hours to read it, which I don't think was necessary. I think it's just one of those things that they do to make it seem much more important than it is.
Maybe. So at the time that it came to me, I'd written and shot Go, which was my first movie. And that was for Columbia Pictures. And the movie hadn't come out yet, but they were really happy with the movie. And they were looking for something else for me to do. And I actually already done a rewrite on the movie Blue Streak, which was a Martin Lawrence comedy. It was written for Nicolas Cage, but I rewrote it for Martin Lawrence, because that's I'm naturally the guy who should be writing for Martin Lawrence. And so Columbia really liked me a lot, and they were looking for something new for me to do. So this book came from my agent. So basically, you get a phone call, because this is sort of pre-email, you get a phone call saying oh, hey, we're sending over this book for you to look. It's called Big Fish, a very general description of what it's about. They said they loved this book and should really take a look at it. But you say 24 hours. I really think I had essentially 12 hours. And the time was basically they were going to be showing the book to other people. So if I wanted to attach myself as the guy to write it, that's when I would have to declare my intentions. It's like, you know, sort of like pledging a fraternity. Like, this is me. And I got it, and it's just a box of pages. It wasn't, you know, just a manuscript box of pages. So I'm flipping pages, and I remember standing at my IKEA table and just oh, I'll read a little bit. It's good. And I read exactly what you just read, that first thing. Well, that's a provocative intro. And so I'm reading it, and I realized that this book I'm reading is just a bunch of these little tiny fragments. It's these little tiny stories. And I love mythology too. So I recognize he's doing something about Odyssey. There's stuff here that this is deeper. It's about this guy named Edward Bloom, and it's about this story of this man's life. But I'm like, well, who is this narrator? Eventually you figure out his name is William or Will. But it's just these little fragments. But even as I'm flipping pages, I'm like, well, the narrator, he's my age. And the father is my dad's age, because that's easy to do. And I realized that, oh my God, the father's dying. It's like, well, this is a chance for me to actually explore all the stuff about my dad who died a couple of years before then. And I would never write the autobiographical version of that, but it's a way I can sort of do that without doing it. And so I started to recognize, I know what it's like to be walking on eggshells when someone is dying in your house. I knew all these things. And even as I'm flipping pages, I'm like, And the Will character, he'll have a French wife named Josephine, who does not exist in the book at all. But literally, like halfway through reading the book the first time, I created Josephine because Will would need someone to talk with. His mom will be an important character. And so I'm adding all these things. And so you recognize these little tiny stories that Daniel's built into the book. And it's like, God, I wish I could put a bigger box around some of these things. And it's like, well, how about a circus? And so a circus is a way that you can combine a lot of these elements of like this mean dog. Well, that could be the circus owner, and like these labors of Hercules, that could be the elephants. And like, so it's ways to combine these things. So literally as I'm going through the book, I'm kind of reshaping stuff and like making a movie in my head. Cause if I didn't see what the movie was, I couldn't attach myself. And by the time I was done, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm doing this. I think this is what it is. And it's, you know, it's like he inceptioned me, and like it felt like, well, this is a movie I should make. And so then I have to call people and convince them like, this is a movie to make. So then the process is going to Columbia Pictures, which was the only place that I had, or Columbia TriStar, the only place I had a relationship, the only place that they would have let me take the book to and say like, hey, you should buy this weird little book for me that is going to be a difficult movie to adapt. And so I would have to pitch it. And it's like the weirdest thing to try to pitch. But I said, it's a story of a man's life the way his son would tell it. And so everything's these crazy exaggerations. And yet the son is trying to figure out what's true behind these stories. And we're like, well, what's it like tonally? I'm like, well, it's funny. And then it's funny. And then it's funny. And then you're laughing through tears. And then it's over. And they're like, okay. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but they were mostly buying it because it was inexpensive for them to buy. And I couldn't work for anybody else until I had actually written this thing. And so they could keep throwing other work in front of it, so I wouldn't work anywhere else. And so they threw Charlie's Angels in front of it, and they threw other rewrites for them in front of it. But eventually I got to really work on Big Fish.
So from the studio's point of view, they were kind of putting you under a long-term contract until you got through this very difficult book to possibly adapt. Yeah. But that's fascinating. So, and you did this all in basically one 12-hour read of it? You kind of put it together in your head?
It takes five, like an hour and a half to read.
You can read the whole book about an hour and a half. So
really slow. It took the plane flight down a little bit.
So no, it really was that quick. And you see sort of, you know, sometimes you inherently sense like, well, this is what the movie feels like. And so much of the screenwriter's job, and the thing I have to keep reminding myself when a director or a producer drives me crazy, like, how do you not understand this, is that the screenwriter is the only person who's already seen the movie.
Right.
And I'd already seen the movie of Big Fish just by flipping through this, and I didn't know all the details, but I knew what it felt like. I knew sort of what the journey of the movie would be. And so it was a matter of convincing people that I could do that. Mm-hmm. And then finally meeting Daniel, and that was a chance to, like, I had the rare opportunity of having, like, a living author who was not a nightmare, who we could actually talk about this book that he'd written.
Yeah, but even after this process, I don't know, you said somewhere, or I read somewhere, that the best author to work with is a dead one.
It is true. The best authors are the dead ones, because they can't sort of mingle and mess things up. But Daniel was great, and I think you were, was it an IHOP? Like, where did we actually meet?
Sbarro's.
Okay.
Sbarro's pizza. He was working on DC in DC, and I live in Chapel Hill, so we drove to a halfway point between those places, and we had our seconds come up, and they killed each other, and then we sat down, in the Sbarro's, and he brought out this really fancy. This is the first screenwriter I've ever met too. When he drove up, I mean, I was expecting a guy in a car with like an Isadora Duncan scarf blowing out the window,
that's so John. It really is.
So John, and he came out and he was wearing a t-shirt and shorts, and I looked at his shoes and I said, "Oh man, those are cool shoes. Where did you get them? And what are they called?" And he goes, "Skechers." Yeah. It's like, oh, I guess I'm behind the times. He was already making fun of me, and so we went in and talked about into this pizza place, and he recorded the conversation. And it was about a 3-hour conversation, which he has on his website, actually. You can read it. And it was so comforting in a way that I didn't even know that was necessary or important to me, but to hear how well he knew the book and how the spiritual or the important underpinnings of it were, he saw them and he believed in them, and that's what he wanted to transmit or transfer to the screen and to adapt. And the whole adaptation process, and then what I've learned so much about it through dealing with Big Fish through all its incarnations, is a really serious artistic process. And it's one that it's more like adoption, and I feel like I gave the book to John, and he could dress it up however he wanted. He could send it to whatever school he wanted, the whole idea of, which people ask me all the time, it was your baby. And, did you read the script and tell him, oh no, this is, you can't do this, to my book. It's for, to me, and I know authors do that, which I find unbelievable. John didn't tell me how to write the book, and that I would try to tell him how to write a screenplay is just ridiculous.
But John, did you feel a certain, obligation to try and honor the spirit of the book, because it is so deep, the spirit in it?
I loved the book, and I loved the way it made me feel. And so I think if anything, I was trying to honor the way it made me feel. But really, I think my first responsibility was to the movie and to the audience, and to letting it be what Big Fish wanted to be on a big screen. And so sometimes there's this perception that adaptation is like you're ripping the pages out of the book and carefully feeding them into the projector, and there's somehow it happens up there. And terrible movies happen that way, because they're not written to be movies. They're written to be just a little translation of what happens in the book. The luxury of Big Fish is that it so wasn't a movie in its initial form that there was never the expectation that it's going to be exactly that, or that those moments have to happen. So there was a lot more freedom about sort of how stuff could be portrayed. It was the hardest thing I'd written by far, just to get that book, to get the movie started, because you're telling two storylines that need to overlap in challenging ways. You have the present day storyline of Will and his father, his older father, and sort of their contentious relationship and that journey. But you also have the story of Edward Bloom's life, the way he imagines it, the young man growing up through these things, and to be able to figure out ways to move back and forth between those two. Just those first 10 pages where you're establishing for the audience, this is what this movie is like. This is how voiceover is going to work, how we're going to get, this is how to watch this movie, was incredibly hard. And the closest I've ever come to that sort of ripping the pages out of the typewriter and crumbling them up and starting over. I had to, it was a good 2 months of just getting those first 2 pages, those 10 pages written.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back looking at seemingly unadaptable books with screenwriter John August and author Daniel Wallace, discussing the adaptation process of Big Fish on his journey from book to screen to musical.
Well, this is really early in your screenwriting career, too, because You Go is this hot independent film that the director,
Doug Liman.
Doug Liman, yeah. It was his second film after Swingers, right? And you had written a short, I think, prior to that, but really, had you written some other material prior?
I had. So the short version of my career was that the first thing that got me an agent, got me attention, was a script that's actually more like a Big Fish. And it's called Here and Now, and it was a weepy. It was set in Boulder, Colorado. It was that classic script that a bunch of people here have probably written, where you're like, I may only write one script, so I'm going to cram everything I know about everything into one script. So it was overwritten, but like, in its overwriting, it was actually, you know, there was good writing in the overwriting too. So people liked it and got me an agent, got me started. The first things I got hired on to work on were adaptations of kids' books. So I adapted How to Eat Fried Worms, which is a famous Thomas Rockwell book, and A Wrinkle in Time, the big sci-fi classic. And so I got pegged as being the guy who does kids' book adaptations. And so I wrote Go as largely like a, well, screw you, I can write other things. And Go, I think, sort of like Big Fish was for Daniel, was like, this is the movie I want to see in the world. This is the movie I'm writing for myself and not for everybody else. And people really liked the script and sort of got me started writing other things. So by the time I was actually working on the adaptation of Big Fish, I had already done, Go had been produced, Charlie's Angels had shot, I'd created a TV show, I'd been fired from that TV show. My life had sort of gone through some changes, but I was still, you know, I was 28, 29 years old and trying to write this big movie about fatherhood and mortality and all these things. And I was very much the Will Bloom character, and that was my perspective on everything, how I was going into things. And I remember getting the first notes back from the people who read it at the studio or the places. It's like, we don't like Will. We don't like Will at all. And I'm like, that's great. I'm Will. So thank you very much. I feel awesome right now. So I'm really going to pay attention to all your other notes because you just told me you don't like me.
When they were getting actors for all the roles, then they finally got Billy Crudup to play Will. And by this time, there was email.
Yeah.
Email was invented.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I emailed him and I said, oh, this is so exciting. Billy Crudup's playing me in the movie. And John wrote back and he said, he's playing me in the movie. And,
dueling Billies. But so, but it still was a really gutsy move, I think, particularly if you've just been fired off a TV show, to pick this mercurial, fabulous little novel, yeah, and to then say to a studio, no, this is going to be something I'm going to do really soon. So, but now, did you stay in touch during the process?
We did. So Hugh asked, what's going on? I'm like, nothing's going on. Because like literally, it was about a year and a half, I think, after we set up the rights that, before I even started working on stuff because I was busy doing other things. So eventually I was able to sit down and start on it and deliver the script. And the studio, they genuinely did like it, but they also said, this is an incredibly expensive, incredibly tiny movie that we will never make. So like, we genuinely like it, we love you, but write something else, because they didn't even want me to do my next draft on it because they're like, this is just not a movie for us. And so at that point, it was just me and the book and the script. And so I said, like, well, what if I got some awesome producers? Like, well, I don't know. So I went to Dan Jinks and Bruce Cohen, who at that point had done American Beauty, which was also a tiny but really successful movie that was also difficult. And so I said, hey, would you read this thing? Would you consider producing it? And they said, yes, we'll absolutely do this. And so the studio kind of had no choice but to give me another pass and to let me do another thing through. And with Dan and Bruce's help, a very important change happened in the third act, which is that the Will character, in my initial drafts, he did tell the story of like taking his father to the river and what that was, but he told it to the crowd that was at the funeral. And Dan and Bruce said, no, he needs to tell that. What if he told that story to his father and got his father to that? What if that is the death story that actually happened? And that was that moment. It's like, well, that's a really good idea. And so eventually I just had to do that. And I did that and the script was better. And so we went back to the studio and they said, that's so much better, and we will still not make this movie. So Dan and Bruce said, like, well, what if we got a big director on board? And they're like, well, and so it's like, well, who do you mean? Like, you know, like Spielberg, like maybe we consider it. And so they went to Spielberg, and he said, yes. And so Steven Spielberg signed on to direct it, and that was amazing. And my first conversation with Steven was, we were in editing on the first Charlie's Angels, and Big G, the editor, director of that, is like, hey, McGee, can I use your office? Because I have a phone call coming in. It's like, oh, that's great. Like, who's calling? It's like, Steven Spielberg's calling, McGee. And so I went up and we had this great conversation about the script and sort of what he loved and Norman Rockwell and his vision for what he was going to do with the movie. And so for about a year, he was attached to direct Big Fish.
On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. This episode of On Story looking at seemingly unadaptable books with Fred Stripe speaking with Big Fish author Daniel Wallace and Big Fish screenwriter John August.
So, okay, so the rest of my conversation is gone because I assume there were bumps in the road and horrific tales and all his lost moments like any great story, and you're telling me it was fine?
It was honestly fine. So the it really wasn't one of those, like, you know, horrible, like everyone was at each other's throats. Once we were on a track with Tim Burton, it was a really good, happy, progressive way of working. Yeah, I wasn't worried about it being Burton-esque, and there are elements that feel like they lend themselves really well to Tim. So, like, I very much wrote Amos Calloway for Danny DeVito, but Danny DeVito also fits very well in a Tim Burton universe. And the idea that the circus works very well. And there's a lot of things that feel like they're Tim Burton-y kind of elements. The witch feels like a Tim Burton-y kind of element. So Tim wanted to shoot the whole thing in Alabama, I think just mostly so that the studio would never want to come to Alabama. And so we just have the freedom to do that. He had this remarkable production team that we could be outside shooting and, like, the clouds could gather and it could be threatening rain. And within half an hour, we could be out from outside to our warehouse stages and keep shooting new things. It was in a remarkable crew and a remarkable cast. That decision of how to handle Edward Bloom, that you needed a younger actor and an older actor to play those two versions. We found Albert Finney and Ewan McGregor, who were a very good match. Mm-hmm. We found Jessica Lange and Alison Lohman, who were a perfect match. There were a lot of things that were just sort of touched and blessed by it. In New York City, I had a meeting with Tim, and we were doing it at the Soho Grand Hotel, and Jessica Lange was there meeting with Colleen Atwood, the costume designer, and I saw these things that Jessica Lange was trying on. I got to see Jessica Lange trying on clothes, which is kind of cool. but I saw the things she was trying on. I'm like, wow, those are, like, surprisingly sensual for a Southern housewife. And so I had the guts to ask her, like, so Jessica, what's your instinct behind why you're picking these clothes? It's like, well, she knows her husband's dying and she wants to look good for him. And I'm like, wow, that is a really good idea that I'm not giving you anything in the script that sort of supports that. And so I wrote the scene that where she gets in the bathtub with him. I wrote that on hotel stationery at Soho Grand. And I showed it to Tim, and then Tim showed it to Jessica, and then it's in the movie. And so we just had those little blessing moments throughout the journey of making the film Big Fish.
So were there other instances of you kind of, this creative process sounds so fabulous. Is it sort of like Woodstock where it's never really going to happen again? You know, or, you know, it sounds really unique.
Yeah, it was really touched, and it was a wonderful process going into it. Like, my very first meeting with Tim Burton was strange than what you want a Tim Burton meeting to be, is that he was doing pre-production in Culver City, and I went into the office and it was dark, and he was laying back in a chair like this. And I'm like, oh, hi, Tim. He's like, hi, it's good to meet you. And he had vertigo, and so he couldn't stand up, and the room would spin. So he had to, like, keep his head in one position, like Stephen Hawking, for the whole conversation. But that was my first meeting with Tim, and it's like, well, that's perfect. And he's going to direct a cool movie.
Had Tim ever read the book prior to reading?
No, I don't know. I don't know that Tim's read the book.
Okay.
I genuinely don't know that he's read the book. He read the script and liked the script and went that way.
There's no reason really to read the book if you're a director. They're kind of battling against each other in a way.
And that's actually one of the things that's been interesting, sort of going back a second time to do the musical, is we would meet with people, creative team people, who, like, oh, I just read the book. And I'm like, the book is fantastic, but it's going to send you in a strange direction if you're to do that. Or even people who, like I watched the movie right before I came. I'm like, please come in fresh and come in with your own set of, like, non-expectations, because it's much better to do that. And so we had one member of the cast who would obsessively go back to the book for, like, you know, how to do stuff. I'm like, I love Daniel's book too, but that's not going to be the best source of information about how your character works.
Right, because it had evolved just like, well, like any character. And Daniel, you're talking about, you know, giving your child up for adoption in a way to a nice family. And, you know, they're going to dress that child and educate them, and they're going to go on their way. And you keep returning back to when they were yours. And what does that have to do with anything other than a little therapy maybe? But in any case, I don't want to gloss over this too much, this part. And the part is, you make it sound like you just sat down after that 6-hour reading of it and just did it. I mean, and it's such a remarkable adaptation of holding on to the spirit, which it so does. Mm-hmm. So what kind of...
I just, you know, I very much looked for what are the worlds of the movie going to be like. And so what I had to build the Bloom House in my head. And so really all these 15 years of working on the project, I have the Bloom House in my head. And sometimes it resembles what it is on the film or it resembles what it is in the musical, but it's actually a separate place that's in my house, in my head. And that house is always there and I can run scenes in that place. And then for the feeling of it, and this is not necessarily the best choice to make, but it's a choice I did. For the emotional moments at the end, I would look in a mirror and bring myself to tears, and then I would start writing. And I did that for a course of about 10 days to write all of those last things. And I can cry really easily. Like, give me about 60 seconds, I can cry right now. But I brought myself to those moments. And so, which I think it worked really well for the movie. The challenge has been, I've had to keep, especially now doing the musical, I have to keep experiencing those things. And it's like, I can't touch any parts of that section without just falling apart. And so I've killed Edward Bloom so many times that it's really hard to deal with those portions of the story, because I always go back to the memory of it summons up all the stuff I had to summon up in order to get those scenes written.
What's really overwhelming, at least for me, was to see the musical and find myself laughing and find myself weeping. At the end, the whole crowd is a mess. And, you know, Norbert Leo Butz is too. And I don't think that's acting. He really has brought himself to tears as the screenwriter did. So, so can we talk a little bit then? Okay, the film comes out and it truly is a beloved film. And, you know, it's so many people's favorites. I've had so many people say that to me. So you're in the glow of that as the author of the book and the screenwriter. And so what happens about the musical? And I know that musicals now are poaching on the cinematic world, which is a really interesting thing, and also with some disastrous results in some cases. But so how did that come about?
I never believed that it would become a musical. I never, ever did. I never took it seriously, not even for a second. Why would this book ever become a musical? I mean, the whole process is, it starts with the book in a way, but then it separates itself from the book, and yet it's all one universe. And John told me, I honestly thought, God, you know, you only live once. Is this what you want to spend your time doing, writing this musical? I never said that, of course. But, but I didn't think it would become a movie either.
Was there a watershed moment then during that 9 years that finally tipped it over to the becoming a play, a musical?
Well, when Susan Stroman signed on to direct it, because she's sort of the big name that you'd love to have direct your musical. And so what's so vastly different about writing a musical versus writing a book or writing a screenplay is that no one actually reads this document. You perform the whole thing for people. And so Andrew Lip and I have had to act and sing and perform Big Fish about 150 times. So it's like, Andrew's a beautiful singer and an amazing pianist. And so he would do the heavy lifting of the singing, but he and I would act out every moment of it, like at a table for people. And so to try to get a star on board, to try to get a director, to try to get these other producer, investor-y type people, we've had to do it. So I can sing every song in the show, not especially well, but I can sing them. And I can act, I have all the parts. Carl the Giant is Carl the Giant because I have a bass voice. And so everything Carl sings is because of me. And Don Price is sort of my voice. And so there's things that I do Edward Blum is very much an Andrew Lippa creation. I mean, that's Andrew's singing voice. That's who he is. And so we've had to act out the entire show so many times. And it changes also your writing, because you have to be really honest if you, when you're acting something. Is that, like, if I can't make that line make sense when I'm doing it, no one else is going to be able to make that line make sense. And so it forces you to really look at your writing. The crucial thing with Andrew and I, we wanted to make sure that it felt like one person wrote the whole thing. And so I didn't write scenes and then he would write songs. Everything, we were in the room together and we would talk through every decision together. And he had veto power over any line I wrote, and I had veto power over any line he wrote. And, you know, we just learned to trust each other. It became that sort of creative marriage, and you had to be ruthlessly honest, but also really respectful of sort of what this was. And so the producers were astonished that, like, they just couldn't put us against each other at any point. And, like, we were always one thing. And if something wasn't working, we would go off and figure it out together, but we wouldn't, we were one unit. And that was a really crucial thing. So, you know, getting to know Daniel from the start of this has been an amazing part of the journey, but Andrew Lippa has been sort of the other amazing part of the musical journey, to have someone else whose brain has been shared through the whole process.
Have you ever heard a joke so many times you've forgotten why it's funny? And then you hear it again and suddenly it's new. You remember why you loved it in the first place.
So he said he'll fight the dragon who is 15 feet tall. No way! Dad, that's right, isn't it?
Pretty much.
See? So he was a giant.
That was my father's final joke, I guess. A man tells his stories so many times that he becomes the stories. They live on after him. And in that way, he becomes immortal.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing from Brian Ramos and Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.